Sama. McClung's Chocolate Tea, also known as MCT or McT.
Is there like a scientific fancy pants thing behind this? I remember there was something that is stimulated in the brain.
Lots of dunking.
It smells amazing, folks. That's all I can say. Is like, if you want to, I just wish I could just put this through the fiber optic cables.
Not a thing.
Oh, man.
Well, this particular edition.
Actually, it was a thing once. That was funny. Different story.
Yeah, that was a thing. This particular edition of McT has puer tea leaves and roasted cacao beans, as well as other things.
What edition are we on? There's multiple editions of this beverage.
I have been making this, changing this, optimizing this for at least 5 years.
So this is the fifth edition.
5E?
This is 5E. Guys, this isn't a perfected beverage. You feel like Montezuma sitting atop a pyramid and watching the sun set over your jungle.
Hopefully a little less bloodthirsty, though.
Yeah, hopefully. There is no human blood in this beverage. Jeez. There's cocoa bean.
We're not even God.
That's where I went.
You're not even.
That's where I went, because of the cocoa bean.
Okay.
It's excellent. First sip. Here we go. First sip. Oh. That is a good O.
Oh.
Oh. Let's try the other side of the cup.
Wait, what?
Turns mug around, takes another sip.
It's a bit hot for me at the moment, so.
Okay, that is excellent. And if you couple this with coffee, like, I have two mugs right now, folks, one in each hand. The blackest of black coffee in one, and the amazing McT in the other. They complement each other nicely. Well done, Sir Steven.
But what would they do to your brain?
We are about to find out.
Very well.
Receding hour will tell us what will happen.
Yep.
Well, probably about 5 minutes in now. Welcome to the Positive Perspectives Philosophy Podcast. But no, the Meritives in Philosophy Podcast.
The Meritives?
I'm sure I mispronounced that.
We are meriting our podcast
merits
space.
In philosophy.
I'm just a guest.
Stephen McClung is here with us today, folks. You'll remember him from the Platonic Cognition podcast. We forgot to introduce him that day. And this beverage is stimulating my brain so much that today I did not forget to introduce him. Stephen McClung currently works in the scientific field, but he is also a manager for a multinational corporation. Is the best way I think I can say it.
No, that's true.
And he is moving up the ladder, or so we will hope.
Big stuff.
He's a couple rounds in now.
You make me sound grand.
Well, that's what my job is as an interviewer. I have to make the guest sound grand. And he is grand, so I think he's a grand
fellow.
It's
pretty easy, yeah.
Yeah, it's not very difficult to do.
So today we're going to be talking about Epicurus and Avicenna, two historical figures, both related to the field of philosophy.
I feel like... See, I'm just saying things that come to my mind.
Your brain is like running right now.
I need to do a better job. Okay. McT is like Epicurus. Mm. Smooth. Gentle. Very cool as it goes down. Even though it is hot.
Pleasing.
Pleasurable.
And Avicenna, exactly. Pleasurable. Avicenna is like this dark coffee. Mm. You comprehend the truth of being.
Yeah. But
your
not
thrownness.
Like, not arbitrarily tasty.
Yeah,
no, it's one of those acquired things.
More bold than good.
Yeah, perhaps.
So, maybe you could kick us off today
sure.
in our discussion about Epicurus. For those who don't know, I mean, Epicurus, you've probably heard people say, oh, that is so Epicurean. I went to this restaurant, and it's so Epicurean, you know.
What does it mean?
But what does that mean is the question. I mean, that's really what we're getting at today. And also, guys, Epicurus was a person.
Wait.
He was a person. He's not just an adjective in the dictionary.
Oh, okay. Sounded really weird because I wasn't following your train of thought there, but you just point out, yes, this actually was a person. Epicurus promoted the seeking of pleasure. One of the big topics I wanted to talk about today is actually Epicureanism in the modern day. Mm. And so the easiest link in with that is actually through Thomas Jefferson, who many say, and he himself said, he was an Epicurean. Mm. And so this whole idea of pursuing the good, pursuing the The best, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Those were Jefferson's words. And so that was directly inspired by Epicurus and Epicurean philosophy. And many people don't necessarily know that. It's a bit of a resurgent field of research at the moment based on some of the things I was looking at.
Mm.
So I'm just going to go ahead and post a controversial view here at the beginning. Ooh. So maybe we can use that as a jumping board. I think the American way, the American philosophy, is more Epicurean than it is Platonic or even influenced by Aristotle.
Mm-hmm. I could agree with that.
Just right off the bat?
I could agree with that right off the bat.
Wow.
I mean, when you have certain sects of Christianity that dedicate themselves to the spiritual pursuit of pleasure, and technically Christianity derides pleasure-seeking in a lot of ways, and Christians are on the fringes of culture sometimes. They're not necessarily living right in the bastion of it. So they're like in the hinterlands, hearing of these things from the city, and they're living in it, then I would be willing to place a bet that the center of the city is such as well, if the extended metaphor is helpful. But what does our wizened, bearded guest have to say on these matters?
I can see why you would say that Americans are very Epicurean, and more so than they would be Platonic or Aristotelian. Looking at the national identity of the United States, there's only one, I don't know, incongruity I see, and that's with the Epicurean emphasis on friendship.
Mm.
Mm.
Epicurus taught that... But historically that was there, right? In here in America, we were one of the friendliest countries in the world.
I'm not sure that's considered to be true anymore. I'm not sure we're considered to be friendly towards other
countries. Well, I didn't say in the current
country
historically.
No, I know, but you know, we're all reevaluating history right now.
Okay.
And I'm not sure people consider Americans to have been friendly towards other countries.
Oh yeah.
Ever.
So geopolitical.
Towards other countries.
Geopolitical.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's the only incongruity I would see. But yeah, if intra America.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Seeking pleasure and friendship. Yeah. I think that could describe most vibes of Americans. Yeah.
You think about, you know, the books like The Great Gatsby, and you just see this elaborate
there's all sorts of pleasure
of
in that.
Epicureanism on both of those fronts.
Absolutely. I mean, that's some of the best books. I mean, Hemingway, the way he describes simple pleasures. Just the enjoying of a mug of beer along the Le Dieu Major in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Or a small plate of wine and cheese. You know, things like that.
And that's incredibly Epicurean, because Epicurus didn't really suggest go find the greatest forms of pleasure you can. He more suggested minimize all of the displeasures.
Hmm.
Take the tiny pleasures.
And then
focus on them.
Yeah.
Share them with friends. And because I think he was a little afraid of giant pleasures.
Yeah.
Things that were too good. I think he mistrusted them and thought they would lead
to
greater
wise,
displeasure.
Too. You know, you
can
definitely go too far.
Yeah.
It can break the faculties, you know, break the serotonin and dopamine systems and not help them.
I'm glad you guys both at least engaged with that positively. The reason I brought it up is because I was actually having a hard time formulating and verbalizing how Platonism and Aristotle, Aristotelianism, I suppose I should say, have really influenced American culture in that direct way, whereas the Epicurean philosophy is like right there on the surface all the time. I'm like, well, that's Epicurean, you know?
So easy to find out. You don't have to like go digging for it, because it's right in our documents.
You know, supposedly we're still influenced by Aristotle, but like, is it, how many layers deep is that? Like, where is that exactly? What's going on?
In the sense that he creates innumerable categories, that seems to be a very scientific pursuit, just creating a bunch of categories.
Yeah.
Something that Aristotle probably gave us more than anybody else. At least that would be my instinct.
I think the higher education system in this country is the most obvious remnant of Aristotelianism.
See, that's so strange, though, because that's removed by such a large time gap from Aristotle. I mean, you really got...
Yes, but the modern university was born out of scholasticism, and scholasticism...
was Aristotelian.
Was like an unhealthy obsession with Aristotelian.
It was a weird mixture between Christianity and Aristotelianism.
That.
Yeah, that's true.
Definitely see that. Okay.
Humanities.
Yeah. Just so everyone knows, joke. That's not what I studied in college.
Yeah, just not that I said that. I would like Stephen to recognize. I would like the chair to recognize the floor. Did not in any way mention that he went to school for humanities. But I figured I wanted to poke him with that. Okay, so other further questions about Epicurus.
Yeah, go on.
As far as his philosophy is concerned, how do you think millennials have embraced it, and how do you think they've denied it? If Jacob doesn't have any more further things to say.
Go on, that's right on track.
How have they embraced Epicureanism? How have they denied it?
Well, I don't think anyone can fail to see that the millennial generation stereotype is focused on pleasure of so many different forms.
Are they any different the 60s in that way? How are they different from a previous generation?
There's definitely some looping there.
Here's the difference. The 60s ended. And most people left the 60s in the 60s. The millennials, this is a life. A person with a life,
this
right?
is a lifestyle.
Yeah.
This is an ongoing life. And the word lifestyle comes up a lot. I don't want to do X because it will interfere with my lifestyle.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I'll say I'm not entirely convinced that their pursuit of pleasure specifically is entirely Epicurean. But it certainly has aspects of that. It's almost like a facade of Epicureanism. And then below that, I'm not sure if they're actually... I mean, maybe I'm being too judgy here, but when you have this nice meal, let's say, and you take a picture of it, you post it on Instagram for all your friends to see, are you actually enjoying that meal, is my question. Are you actually being Epicurean in that moment, that taking that moment as a pleasure? Or are you letting all these other distractions seep away the pleasure?
At the same time, there's obviously a desire to share experiences.
I think the friendship side, they're super there. That is definitely a staple of millennialism.
In
these relationships, you trust people, you don't trust systems or anything else.
But also, I think that millennials are Epicurean in how they approach spirituality and the afterlife. You know, Epicurus, throughout his pantheon of gods, he was a heretic by anyone's definition in his day and age, because he only believed there's probably a god, and he probably doesn't care much about me or my friends or what we're doing or what we're not doing. And that the vast majority of people in America, I will say, research has shown, are spiritual. They believe in spirituality. They believe in the idea of a god and the idea of spirits. But that's where it ends. And then if you look at afterlife, Epicurus basically taught afterlife is nothing or doesn't matter. And whether or not millennials believe there is no afterlife or that it doesn't matter, they act in accordance with that belief.
It's so interesting because in every philosophy after Epicureanism, you can almost put them in the box of Epicureanism. Like quotes like, you only live once, YOLO.
Yeah,
that's like an Epicurean clarion cry. I mean, that's kind of dating myself, seriously. Then there's another one. Even in Nietzsche, you say, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And there's a Katy Perry song, and that's another dating that's happening. But it's cultural. It's on the cultural inflection point, for sure.
Yeah.
The idea that this moment will eternally recur, so I'm just going to make this moment amazing. That's almost like a more intellectual Epicureanism.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think all of this is just right there on the surface where we can see it in culture. Now, kind of a counter question. How much of this do you think is influenced by Epicurean? Or how much of this do you think was just kind of a natural progression of the other things that were going on culturally in previous generations?
The interesting thing that immediately comes to mind to me, and then Stephen, feel free to say something completely different from this, is that there's a portion of Christianity that is Epicureanism because of what they read in Ecclesiastes, which they consider to be God's philosopher. And it's a very Epicurean book at times. It says, go your way, drink your wine, eat your bread, let oil never be lacking on your head, enjoy the few days of your life with the wife of your youth, for this is what God has given you under the sun. So a portion of that, to me, seems Epicurean.
Yeah.
So there's almost a crossroads there. Or is that a incorrect view.
Bringing up Ecclesiastes is an interesting point because I agree at least certain portions of Ecclesiastes are very Epicurean.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's well
Portions acknowledged. Are definitely not.
Some portions aren't, and there's certainly a focus on maybe the more difficult things in life as well in Ecclesiastes, which I don't think is Epicurean. You know, putting your mind in the house of the mourning, of mourners.
Choosing displeasure.
Yes, in order to make yourself wise is not necessarily Epicurean.
But what if I get to a point where I have pleasure in the displeasure?
That's unnatural. I'm not even going to engage with that. Yeah.
Is it really, though? We'll have to get to the proof of truthful later because we just made it.
At minimum, not Epicurean.
Yeah.
All right. Interesting. So we've done a little bit more of delineation of the boundaries of Epicureanism. You want to restate your question for Stephen?
Not particularly.
I remember the question. I remember the question. I think that where our society is regarding its philosophy, its undercurrents, its Epicureanism, was all set in motion by the propaganda, I'll use that word, the propaganda of the revolution and the founding of our country. Now, the propaganda of the revolution and the founding of the United States can be found in things like Common Sense, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Federalist Papers, not even to mention all of the newspapers that came out during that time. I think that most, if not all, of where we find ourselves today and the path we've taken to get here was set in motion by the propaganda of the founding of our country.
And I at least want to delineate a bit there because it's not, I don't think you can make the case that the motions were an intentional, like, we're going to set the country and the culture down on this route based on our propaganda. That's certainly way too genius level for them.
Could they have? Because look at the adoration of ancient Greece in the architecture. I'm a conspiracy theorist.
I'm sorry, what?
Look at the adoration of ancient Greece in the architecture, ancient Egypt and our obelisks.
Coffee.
I mean, there's just so much backward-looking language and building that happens. And that, to me, is just really powerful. I'm not even making any value judgments here, whether it's right or wrong, whether it happened or didn't happen. I'm just saying, it seems evident to me.
I agree with the problem you raised, Jacob, and I agree with the point you made, Brandon. The propaganda, and I'm using that word very specifically, from the founding of our country, seems to have been engineered with a thorough knowledge of the trajectory that history had been taking up until that point, and with the intentionality of changing that trajectory. And I don't think they were genius level enough to predict where we are today, but I think they were completely cognizant of the fact that they were changing the trajectory of history with what they were doing when they founded this country.
Or at least attempting to, right?
Yes, attempting to.
Yeah, I'll certainly concede that much. The thing that I see is America has gone through several phases, distinct cultures, distinct ideologies since its founding. And I don't think it's necessarily possible to see past the first couple of them. Even if you have studied history thoroughly, when you change that direction, you're steering a car, but you have to take your hands off the wheel when you die. So, you can only go so far.
Yeah, I definitely could see that they did that, though, because when you have people anywhere near the intellectual level of the Scottish Enlightenment getting together in one room en masse and spending a prolonged period of time on something, you know something interesting is going on. At the very least, interesting. Maybe even significant. Maybe even influenced from past beliefs. I don't know. But there's not much we can say about that, really. So what else would you like to tell us about Epicurus? What do you think the Epicurean rebuke would be to the millennial generation?
We've probably already touched on what I think the rebuke would be, and that would be the excess. You know, he avoided intense pleasure. He avoided the heights of pleasure because he feared the heights of displeasure, which would come. And I don't think we have any sense of that.
No moderation.
I'm not sure that there's no sense of that in the millennial generation, but there's certainly sects of it that have no moderation, yeah. I mean, I see a lot of interesting things in the millennial generation. It's almost like an accumulation of wisdom, where they do, some of them, there's trends in modest lifestyles. There's trends in small dwellings. There's these interesting...
The tiny home trend.
Wise things that people do. Gardening, gathering. I mean, right now in the food world, foraging is somehow a thing. When it hasn't been a thing since people were literally too poor to go buy food, so they had to go forage.
The ultimate hipster.
You know,
I'm going to go
like,
forage.
To me, that's a wise thing. It's sustainability. It's a wise thing. And so the generation has all of these marks of embracing, let's say, pausing where former generations continued on. And so I think there is a bit of moderation there. Now, there are certainly areas where that's not recognized. I think sexually it's generally not recognized.
No.
But, you know, who knows?
Yeah, you're not wrong. There's definitely those trends that you're mentioning. Most of the research that I've looked at has ascribed those things to whatever comes after millennials, though. Generation Y.
Zoomers?
Generation Y or Z or whatever you want to call it. Because the millennial generation, depending on what you're reading, ended in the 90s, early or late 90s. So they're all getting pretty old, actually. And it's those younger people that I think are often ascribed to most of those trends that you just mentioned. But they were definitely existent even in the millennial generation.
And I don't think the millennials are too old to be the dominant influence on the world right now.
Oh, yeah. Millennials are coming into their influence right at this moment because all the previous generations are just now getting old enough to step
away. And I think they
will
be for another couple decades.
Absolutely.
At least, probably longer.
And I read an article about savings.
Yeah.
That was interesting. You know, the average savings account and the average portion of income that Americans save decreased through most of the 20th century, and people became less wise with their money. But then, at the end, here with millennials and Generation Y, it's increasing.
Yeah.
People are saving again.
Saving.
Attempting
portions
to save.
Of their income, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I see that as well.
So fitting this into the scope of our narrative, because this is the Narratives in Philosophy podcast, I'll try to ask a question to that end. Do you think, and this is an opinion-based question, do you think the Epicurean philosophy is adequate to lift the human soul out of its morass of problems? Do you think the Epicurean philosophy mitigates against any problems? Or do you find that it falls short at a certain point, and if so, at what point might that be in your estimation?
I think that's a good question. I'll just pose a quick answer before Stephen gives his thoughts on it. We've talked before about the concept of deity and this sort of existential beyond.
Yeah.
And Epicurus very specifically does not want to go towards the existential beyond.
Doesn't even want to touch the existential
beyond. He doesn't even
want
to think about it. He doesn't want to point to it. He wants to stay right here, that lowest level. And he thinks that all the wisdom, all the pleasure is right there at the lowest level. To me, at the very minimum, that disagrees with the large majority of other philosophers throughout all of history.
Yeah.
And so, without even putting my own words to it, he's certainly in a minority, and I think that's going to be a problem. Just on the basis of all these other philosophers saw purpose and meaning and all these other interesting ideas is worth pursuing.
Yeah.
Virtue and others.
Interesting.
That Epicurus doesn't recognize.
It's interesting because he finds the common denominator between all of the things. Plato describes the life of contemplation. What were some of the other lives he mentioned? Because he says the life of pleasure is one life, but who's to say that pleasure does not occur in some regard in the life of contemplation? Or in the life dedicated to religious pursuits. I think the thing I'm getting at in this question is pleasure for how long? And maybe I'm even espousing another intellectual form of Epicureanism by sideways positing that you need to pick the belief that gives you pleasure for the longest amount of time. And if it only carries past, and if it only carries up to the moment of death, then that's not long enough.
Okay.
So in an interesting way, I'm almost espousing an Epicurean belief. But now there's a lot of things for Steven to interact with besides the question. We'll just let him think.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to the question. I like to answer the questions. I would answer it from a historical perspective, and this is, of course, my opinion. But Epicureanism came onto the scene during the Hellenistic era in Greece, and it had other philosophies to contend with. Of course, Aristotelianism was just beginning, and there were a couple other odd philosophies going on, but Epicureanism didn't take for most people. It did not dominate the scene of the Hellenistic era. What ended up dominating the scene was Stoicism, and of course, Stoicism became the mainstay of the Roman Empire that supplanted the Grecian Empire and lasted a very long time. I think Stoicism was much more successful in helping people in the human condition than Epicurean was. Epicureanism seems to have only helped a small number of people at a time. And I can't really think of any other portion of history after that where a large number of people espoused Epicureanism and then it worked for a large period of time.
Yeah, it's almost like Epicureanism is a philosophy of the wealthy. You have the largesse to be able to choose your pleasures, choose your poisons, so to speak, and to limit them.
Oh yeah, it reminds me of pre-revolution France. Aristocracy is what it really reminds me of.
Yeah,
very interesting. Well, we can maybe transition now to Avicenna, which is a blinding transition. Like, you might feel like your neck just snapped. But we could also just check in with the MCT. I gotta say right now, I feel like I've got a buzz.
A buzz?
And there's no alcohol in this. Maybe it's the combination of the coffee and the
MCT. Yeah, you have to drink much of your coffee.
There's something going on in my body right now, and it's an amazing thing. But anyway. So, Avicenna, for those who don't know, I believe was a Islamic philosopher. Why did we study Avicenna in this book club go-around? I always thought that was interesting that we studied him in relation to Epicurus.
I may have forgotten, so Stephen, do you know?
Yeah, they were both so odd. They were both out of the
really?
Normal.
That's
yes,
good.
We chose them because they
oh,
were
that's
both
right.
weird.
They were both not culturally well accepted.
Interesting.
Isn't that right?
Or at least not in the Western.
And they were both removed from the trees of thought that we had been going down.
One
so
of
take
a branch.
They were heterodox, right? Is that the
yes.
right?
Yeah, that's
yeah.
the word. That's the word.
Yes, that's
okay.
why we did them together.
Interesting.
I always thought there was some interesting similarities between Avicenna and Thomas Aquinas.
Oh yeah, and they're basically contemporaries. Avicenna yeah. came shortly before in time.
Aquinas was a hack. He was a wretched hack. He read the Islamic philosophy.
Yeah.
Secretly has Avicenna under his bed at night.
I mentioned it in the book club, but either Aquinas stole the proof of the truthful or he came up with something similar a couple
that
years
happens,
later.
Though.
I mean,
people
we
come
claim
up with
that
things.
That's how science works, is that people in isolated positions come up with the same theories and that gives them merit somehow.
Hmm. That's interesting. Well, you've mentioned this thing, the proof of the truthful, which my questions really center around that and your fable. Maybe you could first tell us about your fable that you wrote during this particular month. I guess this was a year ago now. A year ago during book club. Why did you write the fable? What was your inspiration? And for the tell
what
us about
was
the,
it? Yeah, tell
yeah,
us about
tell
the
us about the characters and tell us what they represented in your mind.
Sure. Well, when I was studying for this book club, I like to ground what I learn in history. So I familiarize myself with the person before I read what the person writes and with the historical context of the person. So after I studied for this with Epicurus and Avicenna, I had a general idea of the kind of person Epicurus was and a general idea of the kind of person Avicenna was. Now, of course, that it's going to be flawed because of history and the time gap and everything else and my incomplete knowledge of them. But I had an idea of the kind of person. So when I wrote this fable, I basically had the kind of person Epicurus was in mind. And I wrote him as a puppy. And the kind of person Avicenna was, and I wrote him as a root.
A root?
A tree's root. To be very explicit here, this
in
is a root in the ground.
A
yes.
root in the ground, and a puppy running on the earth.
Could it have been a Groot?
A Groot?
Sorry, move on.
They could have made a baby, and it was a Groot.
Avicenna was too verbose to be a Groot.
Excellent point.
That's
yeah.
good. That's good.
So that's kind of where I came from. So I had this puppy who was Epicurean, and I had this Root who was an Aristotelian Muslim, essentially.
Aristotelian Muslim.
And then I wrote a fable where...
Okay,
none of that mattered, okay?
Yeah,
I wrote a fable where none of that mattered.
It's a very simple story.
Yeah. A fable where none of their ideologies came into play, just their person.
And you can read this on positiveperspectives.net, by
an
the way.
Amazing
website.
Listen to the pod, listen to this podcast, listen to the book club, or read it on the website.
Yeah.
So what happens? It's a very short story to summarize in a sentence.
Sure. We have a puppy who loves to run, and he is running. And he gets tripped. He falls, he hurts himself, and he realizes he was tripped by a root. And then the root speaks to the puppy and says, "Why did you strike me?" And then the puppy and the root argue. Well, hey, you hurt me and tripped me. And the root's like, "Hey, you struck me, and I'm just sitting here in the ground."
So then what is the inflection point between Epicurus and Avicenna? Why is it that Avicenna and Epicureanism conflict or are brought into conflict? Because there's a conflict in the fable.
And then they also talk past one another.
Yeah. How does that occur?
Yeah, they ignore one another. The puppy eventually asks to be friends with the root, and the root says, "Yeah, no." And then the puppy's bored and runs away. So what the fable says, and what I believe, is that this Aristotelian Muslim and this Epicurean are incompatible. That's what I believe. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this fable,
yeah.
to show their incompatibility.
And it does highlight certain aspects of that incompatibility pretty well. I think in layman's terms, you know, that the fable shows, okay, they don't connect here, they don't connect here, they don't connect here.
Interesting.
And then you can kind of bring the interpretation of the fable in and say the details of why philosophically that it just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So apply this to Epicurean friendship then, perhaps. The Epicurean ethos, if you will, holds friendship up as this paragon, and even in the Greek idea, friendship was seen as this powerful thing, according to, you know, Socrates, the mouth of Plato. How does your fable teach on friendship?
Well, one way you could look at it is the puppy was busy serving himself. And the root was busy serving the tree. And in order to remain consistent with those two things, the puppy can serve himself by making friends. That's one form of servicing himself. He's serving his own needs, his own desires, his own pleasures. The root, however, has more constraints. The root cannot necessarily become friends with someone, because he is serving the tree. So the only way he can become friends with someone is if that person was also serving the tree, or if it was in the tree's best interest.
Interesting.
So as far as friendship goes, the Epicurean really has no barrier to forming a friendship. Unless that person is just going to cause pain.
Indeed.
And continuously cause pain, then the Epicurean would run away from that. Whereas the root, he has big barriers to forming a friendship. Essentially, like, you better be getting me extra nutrients and water for the tree, or helping me to work faster, harder. Otherwise, I have no use for you.
So your ethos in the thing you're saying about friendship is there's two types of ways to make friends. You were saying the Epicurean way to make friends is to serve oneself, and the Islamic Aristotelian way to make friends is to serve some higher structure. And that is that word structure. So, okay, that's interesting.
I mean, the similarity is there, though. You're basically going to make friends that serve whatever you hold to be the purpose,
mm-hmm.
the true meaning of your life.
There's still pleasure in both of those pursuits.
And so whether
the
that's...
the root and the pursuit, you know, of the dog, yeah.
Yeah, it could be within yourself,
huh.
You know, that center. And so if that's the case, then you're going to find friends that help yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be in something else, like the root does. So it's still a similar concept. It's just where that location is. And changing that location makes groups incompatible.
Very interesting. All right, well, that is what I wanted to know about the fable. What questions do you have?
Well, what else? Do you have any other thoughts about your presentation that month?
I think we plumbed the fable pretty well. I'm still blown away by that doctrine of Epicurus that I mentioned in the presentation. He has a doctrine that says, and I'm paraphrasing here, if you accept something to be true baselessly, you know, for no reason, you just accept it, then you've lost your grounding of truth. Like, it doesn't matter if everything else you have accepted as true is grounded on something, just the one thing you accepted as true with no grounding undermines everything else you believe, so you can no longer be confident in your perspective of truth.
Do you agree with that formulation?
At least partially, yeah. I think it's an excellent counter to Epicureanism, which is why it blows me away that it's one of
is that all
his
Senna's
doctrines.
Or
no, this
no,
is Epicureanism.
Right, that's why I was
it's like self-defeating.
I can't remember, Doctrine 24
strange.
Or something. It's one of his doctrines. And yeah, I think it's an excellent counter for Epicureanism, and I think it's an excellent explanation of where we find ourselves in as a culture and as a country right now.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Virtually everyone seems to have accepted something baselessly. So
well,
virtually
what?
Everyone seems to have lost.
Is it not base? The paper says it, so I believe it. The Chrome front page news says it, so I believe it.
It
I
is
mean, what is your base? How do you define your base? What's a good base?
When we talk about epistemology, which is what we're doing, we've had a really hard time finding bases in general.
Mm-hmm.
In past episodes on this podcast, we've tried to find where are bases for epistemology. And yet, he's pointing to a piece of paper, probably
so
some notes.
This is probably actually something that fits into this discussion so very well. All
right.
I walked out of Walmart, and I found this on my car. In all capital letters, I feel like I should shout when I read this.
Feel free.
Do you deserve more out of life than death and taxes? Question mark.
Whoa.
God thinks you deserve.
Oh.
Okay, so that's how it begins. So right away, the burden of proof is on this guy. I could accept this baselessly, like Steven said.
That's true.
You know what? I do deserve more out of life than death and taxes. Those are the same thing.
Those are the same thing?
And there are, like, and this is a manifesto of 25 different points. Point number one.
Oh, wow.
Everyone lives by faith,
hold on,
whether you are religious or not.
Did you really have a manifesto placed on your car outside of Walmart?
I'm not kidding. This happened. I bought a wheelbarrow shovel gravel when
yeah.
I came outside, and this is placed in the handle of my driver's seat.
Wow.
So the very first claim of this manifesto of assertions. Everyone lives by faith, whether you are religious or not. None of us can consciously comprehend the 1 trillion-plus chemical reactions each day that our body needs to maintain life. Why not have faith in a living God who will grant you heaven's joys?
Wow.
So that's assertion number one. So, and I could keep going here. Let's find another one here. There's a very exciting one down here.
Who has manifestos placed on their car?
This is a good one. In the last days, you will not be able to barter without the mark 666 on your forehead or forearm, specifically. Computer technology is available where computer chips the size of a rice grain can be inserted into these areas. In fact, today's barcodes are contained with three bars whose binary numbers create the numbers 666.
It's like such old news.
Electronics will replace money, credit cards, and checks when the Antichrist rules the world for 7 years before Christ returns. Whoever takes this mark will be doomed to hell.
That's good.
So assertion after assertion after assertion, and the burden of proof is on this manifesto that I have deposited rather perniciously on Jacob's table. So
perniciously. All
right. Here's the good news. An Epicurean would call this trash. And an Aristotelian would also call this trash.
Oh.
So that we have consensus.
Okay, so then here's the thing. How do we form that consensus? How does the proof of the truthful and the Epicurean philosophy... This is a very simple question. Like there's more difficult questions than this, folks.
Yeah.
But I feel like this is a great jumping off point to apply the proof of the truthful right away. How can we look at this as an Aristotelian using the proof of the truthful and say, not true? How do we get to say that? Because who knows? I mean,
I just want to point out, I just looked at the paper. They used eighth-inch margins and then filled the page with words. Like, they specifically filled most of the lines to all the way to the right
margin. Do you see that? That's 15 exclamation marks.
It really is.
I don't know. I really believe it because they really believe in what they say. I mean, it's all in exclamation points. Guys, I mean, the exclamation points make it a little more believable.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay.
They don't even have any sort of contact. It's not like they're inviting you to a church. This is just...
Statements.
This is actually
assertion,
just a
assertion,
manifesto.
Assertion. Statement. But I don't know whose it is. I didn't see who put it there, but, you know, this kind of stuff happens to me, folks. Weird things happen to me when I go out into the city.
It's so true.
So my question here, and this might be denigrating the proof of the truthful to even apply it to this, but I was really curious when I saw this.
Okay.
Eureka!
Yeah.
I want to apply the proof of the truthful to this little manifesto that they printed off. And apparently they asked me here at the bottom, save a soul, copy, and give it to others. Why should I not do that?
Because they used eighth-inch margins.
So there's one reason why I shouldn't do it.
Okay. So if you want to use the proof of the truthful to talk about this, proof of the truthful is the idea that there is a necessary existent. There is one thing that exists necessarily, because all things that exist exist unnecessarily or necessarily, but all of them must be predicated upon other necessary existence. Therefore, there must be a terminus, which is the most necessary.
The most necessary, which we could say is insert God here.
Yeah, insert some sort of universal idea of the good God.
Existential beyond something, yeah.
This manifesto doesn't appear to try and relate
to
an existential beyond.
How is the necessary existent not one of these assertions? Assertion number one, everyone lives by faith. Okay, assertion. None of us can comprehend the 1 trillion plus chemical reactions. Okay, I can accept that. Scientists say that if the universe had expanded 1 billionth faster or even 1 billionth slower, it would not have been formed at all. Another assertion. And apparently scientists said this. All of these things are assertions that seem to me just of the quality of assertion that there must be a necessary existent.
You think... not sure I understand. The assertions here are compatible with necessary existent? Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is, what's the difference between the assertion that there must be a necessary existent at the very top in the terminus and all of these assertions? What's the difference?
I'll say pretty straightforwardly, they are not engaging with the ontological argument there. They are engaging with various other evidences of beyond. They're trying to get you to believe in some sort of God. They don't really say, based on what I saw,
what God it is,
what's going on there. It's more of a spiritual ambiguity. Feels like a deism thing, but certainly there's Christian aspects there because they're relating to picked and
chosen scriptures.
And that's the thing. That's why I'm really trying to connect these two things, because I feel like the argument against the proof of the truthful is that how do you qualify each assertion has a different quality? How can I say that this assertion must be so, this one must not be so? Although this one seems pretty obviously not so because I found it on my car in a Walmart parking lot. But
what I would probably say...
And the eighth-inch margins.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
What I would probably say, you know, I made the claim that the Aristotelian would call this trash and the Epicurean would call this trash. I think the Epicurean would call this trash because Epicurus believes there's only enough evidence in the world to suggest that God exists. He doesn't believe there's enough evidence in the world to suggest anything more than that.
So all of those 25 assertions are unfounded, is what Epicurus would say.
That's what he would say. And then what Avicenna would say with the proof of the truthful, the proof of the truthful only proves that there is one thing which exists necessarily. He would make the exact same argument. None of these things are proved necessarily true. Only one thing is proved necessarily true, and that is the existence of God.
It's interesting.
Now we get into the interesting stuff.
Epistemologically speaking, the necessary is a higher truth than all of these because they're maybe based on science or research or other things.
What's so interesting about this is our epistemology, as we've done this Narratives and Philosophy podcast, it's like it was once a field.
Yeah.
And it has been narrowed and narrowed and narrowed and narrowed and narrowed and narrowed and narrowed until there is one last plot of dirt. That plot of dirt, about 4 foot by 4 foot, is our remaining epistemology. That's what has happened here. Now, whether we're okay with that or not is something we still need to discuss. So now we're jumping off into the existential beyond here. For those who don't, who are just now listening, the proof of the truthful only takes you up to the very precipice. There is some eternal thing. Is that a correct formulation?
There's a bit more.
Tell us more about this proof of the truthful. If there are any other elegances that I'm glossing over too much, then please enlighten us on those.
Well, there's some attributes that are suggested by the proof of the truthful. They're all kind of esoteric.
The standard of good, I think, is one of them.
Yeah, so that he must be the perfect good.
Whatever this one thing is.
Yeah. Okay. And he also must be the perfect... I don't remember how he puts it, but it's this idea of completeness.
Yeah.
He must be complete in and of himself.
Huh.
And I think there's another...
Must it be a
he? I'm not remembering it. No, that's just a colloquialism. It must be perfect, complete in and of itself.
Okay.
And I think there's another, but I don't remember. There's another implication.
Specifically, I'm not sure what Avicenna points out.
I mean, we've discussed it
we
has
have
to
discussed
last
quite
forever.
A bit. Yeah, okay. Outside of time, outside of space, those sort of things are certainly there.
So if we have delineated the proof of the truthful enough, at least on this podcast, because there's a lot of things related to it, I'm going to ask another question then. Where is belief on this spectrum? It's such a bad word, but where is belief? Where is faith? And if belief, as Epicureanism says, has to be given a reason, I have no reason to believe 99.9% of things, if I'm understanding the definition of reasons correctly. Because the plot of epistemology is 4 foot by 4 foot wide. It is so tiny.
Mm-hmm.
We've only proven that there isn't it out there. We can't even say he, we can't even say she, we can't even say they. So where are we? Where is belief on this spectrum? Where are we at here? Where have we been left?
Okay, I'm going to make an assertion
I do not.
I've not researched this adequately enough.
We have 25 on the table. You can add one more. It's okay.
Sure. There we go. I've not researched this enough to even be confident in it myself. But the assertion that I would like to make is that Avicenna probably didn't believe in what we would call faith. He proved everything he believed, mathematically, essentially, you know, logically. That's what Avicenna did.
Yeah.
So I don't think he would subscribe to faith, believing in something just to believe in it.
Interesting.
So
do you believe it's possible, like Avicenna did, to really prove these things that we believe? Is that even possible?
Well, here's a historical anecdote that I find humorous. Before Avicenna wrote everything he wrote about philosophy and theology, he wrote the preeminent book on medicine.
Mm.
He thought medicine was simple, human body and health was simple. He cracked it, he figured it out, he wrote a book about it. Later in life, after he did all of his writings, he got sick and he tried to cure himself and killed himself. Okay? This is Avicenna.
Ooh.
So this man who proved everything to himself, he first proved his understanding of the human body and health and medicine to himself. And apparently, he got that wrong. So, even if Avicenna thought he proved everything he knew about philosophy and theology, we've proven this man to be fallible.
So as far as the burden of proof is concerned, the burden of proof is so heavy, no one can carry it.
Just throwing that out there. What do we think about that? Is that a poetical statement that is in line with the results of Avicenna's life that we look back now in the hindsight of history?
It's possible, but it's equally possible that proving some things is impossible.
Hmm. Proving some possibles.
So there.
Proving some things is possible. Proving other things is not possible.
If Avicenna failed to prove, it could have been because it was too hard, or it could have been because it's not possible to prove some things. And I'm not aware
deity.
Of anyone who's able to counter that.
I can't prove to you that God exists. I can't prove to you that he exists in the Judeo-Christian way that most Americans espouse. Is that a provable fact?
You can't? Well,
I can't.
If you can't.
Do you think it's provable?
You can say, do I think it's provable?
In general?
I'm not going to answer that question. mathematics. So if you look
Why?
At the field
Why
of mathematics.
That question?
Whether or not, because I'm not sure.
You think it might be provable?
I don't think I can say either way. Like, I'm not sure.
This is the kernel of the argument right here. We're at the right kernel, and this is the main question. Jacob, do you think it's provable?
Yeah, it's a hard question.
I'm not a root,
I really
okay?
want to punt it. at least I can elaborate a bit. I mean, if it were able to be proved, I think that's the right tense, then someone would have done it. I've certainly thought about this a lot. There's a field called natural theology that I've delved into a good bit, and it revolves around this very idea, how much of deity can you derive from what we observe in the world? It's a scientific endeavor for the most part. In many forms, it's a very logical and mathematical endeavor. So there's certainly aspects that have made great strides in the modern day, given that we have logic. There's certainly interesting things that we can show, but most of them are actually not theology proper. So,
interesting.
Yeah.
Is that what you were getting at with mathematics? Is there some natural theology in the mathematics you were about to mention?
Yeah, I brought up mathematics because that is a great example of a field where we can prove absolutely a very large number of things.
Okay.
On a small number of predicates.
However, there is an enormous list, probably an infinite list, of things we cannot prove within the field of mathematics.
That's a great example that really helps this kind of coalesce in my mind. Thank you.
Yeah, so like, there's an example. Of course, we only have human minds interacting with the field of mathematics, so we always have that limit, the limit of being human. But
and this is,
it seems like,
folks, the reason I've really beat this horse so hard is because I want you to see why nihilism comes about, and where we get it. Like, I kept on asking that question and beating at the wind, not at Steven, but at the wind, because I want you to feel what it feels like to ask this. Like, say you were Nietzsche. You ask this again and again and again, you get to the end of it, and then, oh, I cannot answer my questions. No one else can answer my questions. What do we do? And that, for me, that has been a historically defeating place to arrive at. So the next question I would say is there any hope in Avicenna's? Or is there any hope that you can give beyond Avicenna and Epicurus to those? And this is getting into our narrative. Where are we at? How do we, wretched men that we are, remedy ourselves?
There's a ton of interesting ideas that are wrapped up in this. There's the idea of certainty. For instance, in the fable, the puppy decides it doesn't need certainty in anything, so it has no certainty. The root decides it needs certainty in everything. And we could talk about whether or not it has certainty. It at least has an illusion of certainty.
Sure, sure.
It's anchored to something else, so it feels like that
it
something else is certain.
It feels certainty, yeah. Another idea that's very interesting would be cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is this idea that when the human mind holds two ideas which are not obviously compatible with each other, the automatic unconscious response is to make them compatible by any means necessary.
And that's what I'm getting, I think. I think I'm suffering from a severe case of cognitive dissonance because I'm left with a 4x4 plot of land.
Mm-hmm.
But there needs to be an infinite plot of land.
You want all the truth, you only have a small bit.
In this definition of truth, that's something we haven't even gotten into.
Oh, we've gotten into that in past episodes. I mean, epistemology, as we've shown, is an interesting field because there's two ways to look at it. There's a small portion of land that we can say, okay, this is sufficiently grounded that we can call it truth. Hmm. And then there's all this other stuff like science and different approaches to determining more truthful things that we can have more confidence in, higher confidence intervals in, even. To speak statistically. So
but there's always
everything outside of the plot of land is hazy,
gamble
to differing degrees.
4x4 certainty, everything outside, you're a gambler whether you like it or not.
Yeah,
maybe that's a bad analogy.
No, it's one way to put it. Gambling and beliefs.
Oofenstein.
And if that bothers you, good, that's the world we live in. You should be skeptical of all of these hazy things. I think that's an appropriate response, one that we've espoused previously.
I'll make one more comment.
It's been a very interesting discussion. Thank you for all of your just going with the flow, even though it felt like I was chasing you with a hatchet.
I'm fine. I think I escaped the hatchet so far.
You did. It wasn't even aimed at you.
I'll make one more thing, one more point, and that's on this idea of certainty and uncertainty and cognitive dissonance.
Hmm.
If, as a person, I need to understand the depths of something before I can accept it or believe it, which is something I guess Epicurus advocates for, then I have just limited my knowledge and my potential to only that which I can understand. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very easy to prove that the knowledge of the universe and the potential of the universe is greater than one human can understand. Mm-hmm. So you've given up ground. You've given up an enormous amount of ground. Mm-hmm. If you decide, I will never accept cognitive dissonance, I must always know that I know what I know, because I know it.
to get more explicitly at a previous question you asked, Brandon, what Stephen's illustrating here is the role of faith. Like, very specifically, we have to actually have some things by faith in order to act in this world.
Interesting.
And to make it less abstract, if we only were to work on these few things that we can know based on predicates that are widely, or that we actually personally accept, then we're not going to be able to function well in the world, intellectually or actually.
Indeed.
And so what we have to do is believe some things. And most of the time those beliefs are conveyed to us culturally. It's, well, everyone else believes it, I would do well to believe in it as well. And that's not an adequate predicate. It's just something we take by faith via culture in this example. So,
interesting.
Yeah, that's where faith comes in.
And I'm glad, because that was what I was hoping we would get to, is that we would kind of dig through the ground here until we hit the bedrock of faith. I was hoping we would get there, because that is the troublesome thing. When I read this manifesto, I see someone who's living in the world of wanting to know that they know that they know that they know something and feel certain of something.
Almost like they're pretending not to have faith?
Almost like they don't understand the difference between faith, certainty, and whatever, cognitive dissonance. I don't know. But when I look at this, I see someone who doesn't like living in a world of cognitive dissonance.
Mm.
Doesn't like living in that world.
You could be even more controversial than that. You could say, if someone believes this manifesto that they left on your card door, they are choosing to live in a different reality than this one.
Hmm.
Because they've chosen to believe they understand reality completely, which automatically means they no longer live in this reality. They live in the reality that they understand.
That's interesting. That's very interesting.
So it's almost as if the faith has taken such an extreme form that they don't even recognize it as faith anymore.
So is it too extreme of a claim to say that I believe in a zombie Jew who died and lived again 2,000 years ago? I mean, how do we draw lines in extremity?
I'm glad you went there, because I was thinking the same thing.
Because that's an extreme thing to believe.
From a Christian perspective, the faith is of that substantial quality. There's actually a Christian would say, well, they might have some weird views, but they're actually taking them on sincerely.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is where the hypocrisy and many of the problems that people point out with the Christian church come into play. They don't actually believe, like act out, what they claim to believe. And so there's some problems there. At least this person is going and posting the manifestos of their sincere beliefs on people's cars, like they would reasonably do if they actually believe all of this stuff.
Well, here's one way to counter that. Say this person who posted the manifesto, which obviously they believe this is it. Is that person willing to take that manifesto, go into a prayer closet, look up at the sky, at the God they propose to believe in, and ask that God, is this right? Are they willing to be wrong, is what I'm getting at.
So you're showing some cognitive dissonance there as well.
Are they willing to be wrong?
They don't want to live in that cognitive dissonance either, it seems. Yeah. Maybe they don't. We can't judge that, but they might not be able to.
Someone who's not willing to accept that they can be wrong also lives in a reality that's not ours. You can't live in this reality unless you accept you don't understand and you could be wrong.
And that's actually, I think that actually spurs from the proof of the truthful right there. If you acknowledge the proof of the truthful, then you have to have some respect and uncertainty for that being in the existential beyond. That ultimate good is the source, not yourself, not your own mind.
Hmm.
And so you can't come to these certainties with such faith, because you can't be certain if that is the absolute truth that is in the existential beyond.
You have to believe that it exists, and you can't believe that you possess it.
Yeah.
It being
truth, God, insert
the good.
Idea of the good here.
And that's the role of revelation, classically speaking. We must have things revealed to us from this absolute good in order for us to take them as certain. And so in the Christian faith, we have revelation through prophets throughout the entirety of scriptures that's recorded. Then we have a sort of ultimate revelation in God dwelling in flesh, the hypostatic union of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So to clarify some
threads
there.
Are you willing to admit that you might be wrong about the hypostatic union of Christ? Are you willing to admit this for the room? Are you willing to admit that he might not have risen? Do you have cognitive dissonance in any way towards the core claims? Where does your cognitive dissonance end? Where does your faith begin? Is there a mixture between faith and cognitive dissonance?
That's good. When it comes to revelation, we actually do take it by faith. So there's a trick there. While I'm claiming that revelation is basically the source by which we can make these manifestos, I'm also simultaneously claiming that there is an aspect of faith when it comes to revelation. We are encouraged because it's of the same, let's say, statistical significance that science is founded on, the eyewitness testimonies and etc. So we do have to have, I think it's positive to have a skeptical view when it comes to revelation, because it will suss out all of the false revelations.
There's definitely room for that cognitive dissonance. I mean, there's searching out of searching the scriptures, there's all sorts of things. But now we're getting into a discussion that I think would be best to have after our episode today.
Very well.
That's just my opinion.
No, I agree. I think we've sufficiently delved off into different waters now.
Yeah. Stephen, thank you so much for answering our questions. Thank you for sharing some very enlightening and thought-provoking thoughts, at least with me. I know Jacob probably has been provoked by these things as well.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us for a second time.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah, it's our pleasure as well.
Yeah, very much enjoyed
it. And to our listeners, feel free to check out the Puppy and the Root post by Eliezer Second on positiveperspectives.net, as well as our YouTube channel, which you may be on right now, for the book club recording of that month, Avicenna and Epicurus.
Indeed. Well, folks, we hope that you continue to follow us in this narrative and ask these deep questions with us, and hopefully arrive at some significant answers. This has been the Narratives in Philosophy podcast, signing off.